Hello everybody again, it's Rick Walton, Cricket Man Wales, and today, in a world first for me, I'm talking science with my new friend, Dr. James Scobie of Mighty Bath University Mechanical Engineering Department, did we say?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah.
Thank you. So firstly, really genuine welcome to you. Fascinating stuff coming up, because we've already had a preamble. What we need to start with, why am I talking to you, in other words? Why are we going to go on about swing? How did you get into the study of a swinging cricket ball, dear boy?
Okay, so it basically goes back to my university lectures as an undergraduate, sitting at my fluid dynamics courses,
okay,
learning all about boundary layers and flows around objects, and relating this to things in real life and things that we have an interest in. I've been a cricket mad myself, but like you, and an interest in it. Could find out that through these lectures that you could explain some of the nuances of what happens in a cricket match,
okay,
and in particular swing bowling, by relating some of the stuff that I was learning about at university.
Okay, yeah. Fabulous. Yeah. So why are you researching? Because I know you're researching it further now. Mm. Do you want to just roll the back on that and tell us, you know, beyond that general interest, if you like, why,
yeah,
or how that occurred.
How that came about. So it was towards the end of my university, I got a chance to do some experiments in a wind tunnel as part of my final dissertation project,
mm-hmm,
and I really look into it in detail. Now my kind of day job is researching gas turbines and gas turbine fluid dynamics. But really what I'm doing is applying all that knowledge and understanding to something that I have a bit of a passing interest in cricket balls, and that's what's led me down into doing a bit of sideline research into this,
okay,
effect.
So the experiments themselves, then, what do they look like? I've seen some of this, mm-hmm, and universe, I will be posting some pictures, inadequately probably, but describe some of the experiments you've been doing then, please, if you would.
So we take a wind tunnel set up.
Yep.
An arrangement, and we have a cricket ball positioned in the wind tunnel, and sometimes we use real cricket balls, sometimes we use models to scale the problem, and we look at the flow around the cricket ball experimentally, and we make measurements of side force as well directly from the cricket ball. So if we know the wind speed that's passing over the ball, we can then correlate that with the amount of swing that's being produced by the setup.
Okay. The risk of giving my dear listeners, you know, headaches or whatever, let's go into the science a bit more. So what,
yeah,
you know, the detail on, because us cricket people know it's something to do with the seam position,
mm,
and the fact that the seam protrudes inevitably kind of steers the ball somewhat, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
But do you want to just tell me, you know, to work through that if you would?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, I've got a cricket ball in front of me at the moment, obviously. You guys online won't be able to see this, but I'll kind of talk it through. If you imagine the ball being delivered with an angled seam, so that sets up two distinct surfaces. You've got the smooth side of the ball, which is the non-seam side, which sets up a very different fluid dynamic situation to the opposite side, which has the seam, and this adds an added roughness to the seam side surface.
Okay.
And if you imagine a golf ball, a golf ball is dimpled for the reason that it means that the ball will go further, it'll travel further due to the dimples, and that's because of the added roughness that's added to that surface. And the same thing happens with reference to the cricket ball. So you have a smooth side and a rough side,
yeah,
set up because of that angled delivery.
And obviously bowlers cultivate that as well, yeah? So
you're trying,
as an opening bowler, you'd be trying to look after
one side better than the other, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then deliver it in a way that maintains that two distinct features, the smooth side and the rough side. And so fluid dynamically, they behave very differently. Do you want me to go into...
Yeah, please do, because I think some people would be... Well, but I think sure, lots of people would be fascinated. But yeah, throw those scientific terms out there, let's hear it, because it's fascinating.
So it's all to do with what we call in engineering and physics the boundary layer, the boundary layer effect, as flow such as air passes over a surface, in this case a cricket ball. And if you banjos can be explained by if you
they are layers around the surface of the ball. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's all if you zoom in close enough to a surface, you'll find that any surface will have an inherent roughness, and this actually causes the flow to stick to that surface. And how flow sticks in different ways is dependent on. Dependent on the different conditions and the different states of those surfaces. And you get two different types of flow in bandular flows. There's laminar flow and turbulent flow.
Okay.
And laminar flow, if you imagine a cigarette and the smoke coming off the end of a cigarette, at the start it will be kind of nice and ordered and smooth. And that's what
straight up,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That'll be the laminar flow.
Okay.
And then what will happen after a certain period of time is it transitions to turbulence. And you get all the sort of wiggly squiggles, the chaotic random nature that comes in, and this is characterized by turbulent flow, and that's what happens when you have conventional swing or a cricket ball. So on this smooth, shine surface, you get laminar bandular flow, and then because of the presence of the seam, much like the dimples on the golf ball, that will trip the flow into turbulence. So you'll get a turbulent bandular on that side. And it just so happens that the turbulent bandular is more resistant to separation. So that's why the drag on a golf ball is smaller, because the separation point, the separation angle on a golf ball with dimples is further back. Therefore, the wake that's caused at the back of the ball is smaller.
This one's hard to kind of visualise. I'm slightly struggling. I mean,
it does help.
You've explained it really well.
It's not complex. It's an observation.
Yeah, do you want to revisit that again, just if you would?
Yeah,
try and make clear what the drag, or the reduction in drag, what's the cause of that? Yeah, is that making sense?
Well, the nice way to visualise it is by bringing the golf ball into the argument. And
if you can get
your head around the fact that a golf ball has dimples to make it go further.
Right.
So if the golf ball was smooth, it wouldn't go as far if it were hit with the same amount of force.
Okay.
And that's all to do with the fluid dynamics and encouraging this turbulent flow that is more resistant to bandular separation.
Okay.
So when you have those dimples, the drag, the wake at the back of the ball will be smaller because the separation angle will be larger. Therefore, the flow will follow the contours and the shape of the ball much tighter and go further.
Really interesting, really. Okay, because we could go on for hours, but I'm on the track. What I want to get to is this, because I can feel the cricket world heaving around me, saying, Rick, ask this guy about humidity and Trent Bridge and that phone. This, because the received wisdom, you know, we all feel sure that humidity actually is a real factor here. So it's going to swing much more. Jimmy Anderson will make it swing much more in Trent Bridge in September than he will at the Wagga.
Mm.
Talk about whether the truth or not of that, please, but also specifically the thing about humidity, because we visited this and it's fascinating.
I mean general cricket insight would tell you that on an overcast day, as we have in England, typically the ball will swing conventionally, certainly much more than somewhere on the subcontinent like India or Australia, and there's no a lot of commentators and cricket captains attributing this to humidity, but really there's no scientific reason why humidity would play a part or have an effect on the amount of force generated by a cricket ball.
Okay, so again, because this is magic, I think, so it's not humidity.
No.
Now, the captain isn't wrong in Trent Bridge, because the ball is going to swing a lot,
but it's not
humidity that's doing that. Scientifically,
yeah,
that's your argument.
What
yeah, you're clear
as,
on that.
As a science community would argue is that, yes, it's absolutely nothing to do with humidity, and we've actually done this experiment here at Bath, where we increased the levels of humidity in the wind tunnel we were testing at and showed that the results remained unaffected. So it's definitely nothing to do with humidity. There's a lot of interesting debate, and the science doesn't really have the answer for everything. In this case, there hasn't been a validated, plausible explanation as of yet for why the ball swings more in overcast conditions. But the best explanation that I've heard is to do with a microturbulence, which is set up because of the sun's rays beating down on the wicket.
Mm-hmm.
So in somewhere like Australia, say, at the Wacker,
yeah,
you've got a nice hot day, you've got these small convective currents that are coming off the surface caused by the heat pending down on the surface of the Earth. And this will affect that laminar boundary layer that I was talking about earlier, because that's very fragile and delicate, and it has to be maintained, and that's why the fielders will go to great efforts to clean one side of the ball and rub it on their whites to polish that surface. And that's all about maintaining that laminar boundary layer on that non-seam side. And anything, even something as minute as this small microturbulence that's coming off the surface, could affect that to such a degree that it would mean that there was no, that the air, that the environment is no longer conducive to swing. And what I think happens on a cloudy, overcast day, as we have at Trent Ridge, say, is that because of the clouds, you stop that microturbulence, to stop the sun coming down, and this will be more this will cause a still environment. You can imagine on kind of overcast days, it's almost uncomfortable at times because it's quite still.
Yeah, sure.
Quite a close environment. Sometimes people refer it to.
So on the one hand, it's clear that the conditions are very different, and that matters.
Yes,
very but on the other hand, fascinatingly, it's not the humidity made that's responsible. Specifically humidity.
Exactly. I think humidity is more of a byproduct, more of a an effect rather than a cause.
Yeah, which for me is fabulous and. Let's go back briefly again, because the GABA, we talked about, and then you showed me an experiment where you put a grid, because I like this discussion about turbulence.
Mm.
Can you just go back, just describe that bit of that experiment, if you would, and the reason behind it, and what you your evaluation of that.
So what we did in our experiment to look into this further was to try and recreate that microturbulence in some level. In our wind tunnel, because in our wind tunnel we have a sort of perfect idealized environment where the flow is all kind of uniform and very conducive, as we were describing, to swing. So to kind of play with that and change those conditions, we added a turbulence grid into the experiment to increase the turbulence levels in the wind tunnel. And what we showed is that, as you'd expect, disrupts the laminar boundary layer and prevents the conventional swing from taking place, because you've now got a very different fluid dynamic environment that's set up.
Okay.
And we tried to match that with data that we had from the literature that meant it was representative from the kind of turbulence intensity and velocity fluctuations that you might find on a typical cricket pitch in somewhere like Australia.
Okay, fantastic. Really, really interesting thing. Which I think can bring us to reverse swing. I have some knowledge of this. I know that speed is a function or is a factor.
Sure.
But what else is responsible for that switch from conventional swing to reverse swing in your view?
So reverse swing is all about the condition of the ball and, as you mentioned, the speed that it's delivered at. So what happens is, as the ball wears and ages throughout the game's play, is that the speed that you get this switch in fluid dynamic terms from conventional to reverse swing, the speed at which that occurs will reduce, and this is well known. So if you add roughness to a surface of an object, you will change again the fluid dynamics of the problem, and adding roughness will reduce the speed at which these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So as the ball wears, you bring the ball into a range in which you can get this effect. So it was no surprise that sort of the original exponents of this were the fastest bowlers in the world that came from Pakistan in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And they kind of realised that if they were to propel the ball at a certain age, at the fastest ball they could deliver at 90-odd mile an hour, they could get the ball to go in the opposite direction that the batsman was expecting. So that's the kind of origins of it.
Okay.
And then since then, we've understood, cricketers have understood, that if they wear the ball sufficiently and to a sufficient extent, that they can bring it into a range that almost our mere mortal bowlers in England can use.
Is this the point that we bring up my favourite bloke on the planet, Mr. D. Warner Esquire, and Australia and Sandpaper Gate?
Yes.
Maybe we'll go flying past it, but clearly that is,
that's
a live issue and has been, isn't it? Extraordinarily.
Exactly, and that's exactly what they were doing. They were, in this case, illegally using sandpaper to affect the surface of the ball, wear it sufficiently so that it brings it into that range of speeds that are obtainable by their bowlers to produce reverse swing.
Okay, magic. Now then, I think I have to nod in the direction of at the analyst, Simon Hughes, who has, like myself, been in touch with you and offered you, well, no, you did some stuff with him. Do you want to tell us a bit about that, if you would?
Yeah, so Simon came down and he brought with him some bowls, that we real-life match bowls, that were aged in different conditions. So we tested new Duke's bowls straight out of the packet. We've tested white kookaburra bowls as well. We looked at pink bowls and looking at the effects that that came from the different manufacturing conditions to that were required to produce it, produce a pink bowl.
Yeah.
And then we also looked at Simon provided some match worn bowls from a match in Dubai where they it was an MCC trial match where they were using kookaburra pink bowls that we set up in our wind tunnel and performed our test to characterise how much this one.
Okay. And all beyond that, I believe there was a sort of mint gate thing going on here, you know, sugary saliva, you know.
This was pre-Warner, but Simon came along and was interested in looking at whether sweet saliva had a true effect on the state of the cricket ball and the amount of conventional swing in this case that was being produced, because as we know, around about the time that Faf du Plessis, the South African captain, was caught with sweets in his
not
mouth.
Yet, I'm sure not alone on that at all.
Ball tampering goes back a long time.
Sure.
Many famous people have been caught.
So tampering with findings on that sugary salivary thing, did it give a sort of extra? Lacquer is probably the wrong word, but you know, in what way did that affect the condition of the ball or maintain the condition of the ball?
That's exactly what they're doing. They're trying to look after that fragile, delicate laminar boundary layer that we were alluding to earlier by maintaining that surface. So for conventional swing, contrary to reverse swing, where you want to age the ball and roughen it so that you can bring the ball into a range where reverse swing is attainable, with conventional swing, you want to do the opposite. You want to look after that non-seam side surface as best you can, legally or illegally, and maintain the smoothness, the condition of that surface to get the laminar flow to cause conventional swing.
Okay. Dougie Brown, I believe, also brought you half a dozen balls. I know, and I've seen them and I've photographed them and I'll put them on my blog. From different conditions, yes?
Yeah.
Did he, clearly he wanted you to do some research on them, but I think what I'm stumbling towards is I quite like the idea. I'm interested in the idea of elite cricket thinking, hang on, maybe we should be tapping James Gobie or equivalent, not that there may be no equivalent to yourself, actually, to find out what we might learn that is to our advantage. I mean, I'm not saying Dougie was doing that necessarily, but...
No, we approached Dougie, actually.
But it's, in your research currently... who else is asking you about this stuff? And might there be something that they could really learn from you that's actually going to give them some kind of advantage? Yes or no? Is that a ridiculous question? Or
so we've talked to people like the ECB in the past, and there's people like yourself, Rick, who come along with a passing interest and trying to align these almost two worlds of real-life cricket practitioners and us here at university doing science experiments trying to explain things from a fundamental point of view. But I think it's difficult to try and draw some distinct conclusions from the work that would give someone a competitive advantage.
Okay.
Just because it's a very complicated scenario in a cricket match. There's lots of factors at play. There's all sorts of things to do with conditions of the balls, the way they're delivered, the skill of the bowler, the environment, so on and so on, that mean that there's no definitive set of rules that us doing experiments in an idealised wind tunnel setup could turn around and say to someone, well, if you do this and that, then you will guarantee this result. It's far more complicated and abstract than that. Yeah.
And that's, I think, lovely in the sense that clearly, actually, there is no substitute, thank God, for a skilled practitioner, you know.
Sure.
And also, I really, you know, one thing that strikes me is it's also really kind of lovely that there is some degree of mystery around what it is. It's not, we're saying it's not humidity in scientific terms. It's not humidity. It is happening at Trent Bridge, etc., etc. That magical thing is happening.
Yeah.
And maybe science can't entirely account for that. It can account for the fluid dynamics, etc., blah, 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 to some degree.
Yeah,
the process, but there is a magic, you know, unless I'm reading it wrong, there is a bit of mystery about that still, yes?
Of course, yeah. We don't necessarily have all the answers as of yet. And I think there's some base level of understanding that we can apply our fluid dynamic knowledge to explain on the outset what is happening, what the causes are. But as you say, I think it's one of the endearing things about cricket is that there is this sort of, it's almost viewed as a bit of a dark art. There's this mystery element around cricket. Some days it will swing, some days it won't. Different conditions play a factor. And I think it's one of the nice things about cricket.
I agree. Long may that continue, actually. Okay. On that bombshell, I think I'm going to draw it to a close. Again, as always, I could talk to you, and probably will, for plenty more time. May revisit at some stage, either through literature or something.
Yeah.
But for now, James, thank you for that.
Thank
really
you,
fascinating.
Yeah, no worries.
Hope to see you again. Cheers.